I'm pleased to have as a returning guest on the Everything Financial Radio program, Mr. Ian Gordon. Ian is president and founder of the Long Wave Group. If you've been a longtime listener to the Everything Financial Radio program, you'll recognize Ian's name, and I always look forward to our conversation together. Ian, welcome back to the program.
I'm happy to be with you.
Ian, in the past we have talked about the ongoing devaluation of paper currency and ultimately what we both believe will obviously be a failure of paper currencies. Since we've last talked a few months ago, can you just talk to the listeners about maybe what's been going on in the world that confirms that we are still headed in that direction?
You know, I really don't think there's any doubt that we are headed in that direction. I mean, paper money is debt money, and debt money is being piling on debt to the tune that the overall debt in the world is now $200 trillion. There's no way that that money can ever be repaid. The world GDP is approximately about $65 trillion. So that's an impossibility. In other words, the world economies cannot basically function to effectively pay back the debt. And the U.S. is simply the world's largest debtor nation, owing better than $18.2 trillion, and that money can never be repaid. The U.S. GDP, which includes the U.S. government contribution to the economy, is a little less than the total debt. So the total U.S. government debt is now better than 100% of GDP. So there's no way that that debt will ever be repaid. And in fact, what's happening is that many countries who own U.S. debt, like China, Russia, and so on, have been reducing their debt holdings of U.S. debt. So the dollars, you know, together with the debt problems for the U.S., the U.S. also has real problems facing the dollar as the world's reserve currency and its petrodollar status.
Ian, let me talk a bit about something you just mentioned, that China is reducing its holdings of U.S. government debt. I think it was a Bloomberg story about a month ago that said that China reduced its holdings of U.S. government debt by $250 billion or a quarter of $1 trillion. And yet we didn't see a tremendous spike in interest rates. How do you explain that?
Well, it appears that that debt is being basically purchased by the Federal Reserve. So the Federal Reserve can create money out of nothing, and it effectively puts the U.S. debt on the Federal Reserve's book. So the Federal Reserve now has massive amounts not only of U.S. debt but all sorts of other holdings such as mortgage-backed securities and so on. So the Federal Reserve has just been creating money to effectively purchase this debt. That's why you really haven't seen the dollar under any extreme pressure. In fact, the dollar has been strengthening against other currencies. And because the U.S. The Federal Reserve, let's not call it the U.S. because an independent private bank consortium, you know, is purchasing that debt.
Ian, that seems like a very dangerous thing to do, to create literally money out of thin air or intangible money, if you will, and exchange it for tangible goods and services. And it seems that that ongoing exchange of intangible for tangible will have to come to a screeching halt when those trading the tangible stuff or the intangible stuff come to the realization that they don't want to do that anymore. Are we close to that?
Well, you know, but everybody's doing it. I mean, the European Central Bank is doing the same thing. It's purchasing debt, and so the Japanese government's purchasing debt. It's even purchasing Japanese stocks through ETFs and so on. So all the central banks, this is the act of desperation that's going on to try to preserve the fiat currency systems worldwide. And the people that effectively aren't playing in that game are countries like China and Russia that have been accumulating gold at a rapid pace, because I think they, you know, they obviously know that effectively that the paper money system, worldwide paper money system, is doomed.
Ian, you know, often when historically you've seen this process happen, that money's literally created out of thin air, follows that there are geopolitical tensions, and certainly there's no shortage of that around the world today. Do you see the end game being something like maybe we saw following the 1930s, where there was a worldwide conflict?
I think that, you know, that's a very dangerous sort of supposition, because a worldwide conflict today effectively will result in a nuclear war, because even if you go to a conventional war, you know, it's the losing side is going to resort to the nuclear option, and so and obviously that would effectively destroy us all. So I think that, you know, hopefully saner heads will prevail, you know, not go that route, and effectively, you know, a new system is going to evolve. A new monetary system is going to evolve. It always does. You know, my work is governed by cycles, and it always does at this stage in the cycle. So we are going to see a new monetary system evolve. And, you know, if you go back to the previous periods in the long wave cycle, you can always see that at what we call the winter of the cycle, a new system evolves. And, you know, so I'm pretty well convinced that the new system will be gold-backed, because the fiat paper money system is collapsing.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there for this segment. Our guest today is Mr. Ian Gordon of the Longwave Group, and we'll continue our conversation with him when Everything Financial Radio continues. Stay with us. I'm pleased to have as a returning guest on the Everything Financial Radio program, Mr. Harry Dent. Harry is a best-selling author. His most recent book is titled The Demographic Cliff, and he is offering the listeners a free copy of the book. You pay only $4.95 shipping and handling, and you can go to harrydent.com to request it. And Harry, welcome back to the program.
Yeah, nice to be back, Dennis.
Harry, talk about, if you would, the premise of your book, The Demographic Cliff.
Well, you know, our first book was The Great Boom Ahead back in 1992, and we foresaw an incredible boom when most people were pessimistic, and we saw the collapse of Japan, and it's all about demographics, that there's been this massive baby boom around the world, and the first one occurred the earliest in Japan, so they had a whole real estate bubble and stock bubble and great boom. I mean, Japan, you know, became a rich country in 3 decades, the fastest of anybody in history, and then Japan just collapsed. Nobody saw that coming except for us, because in the 80s I was looking at demographics and how people move up predictable spending cycles as they age, and you can literally project the boom and bust cycles in any major country in the world, you know, 46 years in advance for the peak in spending. So we saw the simultaneous fall of Japan in the 90s and that the rest of the world would just see their baby boomers hit, you know, the optimum spending rates in the 90s, and then we'd have this great boom. So what this book is saying is, hey, you know, we've seen Japan peak. Now we've seen the bubble start to burst in the United States. Europe is next. And, you know, you can see country by country, more and more countries going to go off this baby boom decline in spending, this demographic cliff, we call it. And so, you know, governments have this point of view. Oh, we just had this big accident, this subprime crisis, this debt crisis, you know, in 2008 and 9. And if we can just get over this, we'll be back to normal. No, we won't. Every 40 years, we see extended downturns like 1929 to 42, late 68 to late 82. We're talking 12 to 14-year downturns, the same thing we projected for Japan in 1989, that they would be down for beyond even the 90s. These things come predictably, and you can't just fight it with some free money. You can fight it short-term, but they're going to lose this game. Debt is only going up. And countries and more countries are aging faster. And the biggest surprise, two big surprises in the next couple of years, Germany has a demographic slide even steeper than Japan had in the 90s, and Japan had, you know, a unbelievable crash and downturn even when the rest of the world was booming, and China is the only emerging country that actually is already seeing demographic slowing. Their workforce is going to be slowing, already has, and China's bubble is going to burst, and there is no such thing as a soft landing after a bubble like this. China's got a bubble that I can't even compare to any other bubble in emerging countries or in developed countries in the past couple hundred years. So China, when it bursts, it's going to fall like an elephant, and there's not going to be a darn thing the Federal Reserve or ECB can do to counter that, because that you're going to see a real estate implosion that's going to make the Japanese one in the 90s look like nothing.
So, Harry, when you talk about China, it seems that China may have already started to see this bubble burst. I think the Shanghai Composite down top, you know, peak to trough anyway, about 40% year-to-date, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
And then you're starting to see the real estate bubble unwind. So you're saying it's going to get worse.
What much worse? And the real estate bubble is the big thing. You kind of had like a sudden stock bubble when real estate started to flatten out and decline a bit. Everyday people suddenly started speculating in the stock market, and so you just had this like 1 year bubble. And in literally 2/3 of the people opening up brokerage accounts and going on margin had a high school education or less. So this was the real dumb money, I hate to say it. And so that bubble, once you get a bubble burst 40%, it's over. And the Chinese government's doing the same thing the U.S. government did in 1929. We had a 40% crash in about 2.5 months, similar to this. And then they got brokerage firms. They pumped, you know, funneled a bunch of money to buy stocks through brokerage firms, prop it up, and that happened for a couple months, and then it just crashed again. So China has burst, but the big thing is the real estate bubble, because the Chinese save 50%, the average person, 70% for wealthy people of their income, and they put almost all of it into real estate. They don't buy stocks and bonds like we do in mutual funds as much. So they're heavily invested in real estate. Shanghai real estate's gone up almost 7 times since 2000, you know, when our real estate bubble started. And so when this thing bursts, it's not going to be 40% or 50%. It's going to be 70, 80% probably. It's going to be probably the biggest bubble burst in our lifetime. And the Chinese, with all that excess wealth, just like the Japanese were doing in the late 80s, their bubble has allowed them to invest around the world, and they're the ones buying up London, you know, and New York, and L.A., and San Francisco, and Vancouver, and Sydney, and Singapore. All these bubble cities are going to crash when the Chinese stop buying, because the Russian, Arabs, and Brazilians, the other big foreign buyers, have already slowed down because they've gotten killed by the commodity crash.
So, Harry, when you talk about China and you talk about demographics, one of the things that came to mind was the fact that China for so many years had a one-child policy. To what extent has that policy contributed to this decline?
Well, that's exactly it. That's the reason they are the only emerging country. Most emerging countries don't peak in their workforce growth and spending trends till 2040 to 2100 for Africa. So China is the odd country out, because they had this one-child policy. And that dated back. It was informal in the early 70s, and then it became, you know, like rule of law late 70s. So that is, you know, on a lag, that is what's hitting them now. Their workforce growth peaked in 2012 and is slowly starting to shrink. And then about 2025, they go off a cliff just like Japan. And I'm saying, and again, my strongest predictions are for China, they have overbuilt their economy by pushing people from rural to urban areas too fast, building condos for nobody. 27% of condos in Chinese cities are just sitting there vacant, empty, and owned by some semi-wealthy person who's not even renting it out. It's just absolutely crazy. They've overbuilt everything, industrial capacity, roads, bridges, railways. 10 to 15 years out, by the time they recover from this overbuilding bubble, they will be declining in aging as fast as Japan did in the 90s forward. So China has further urbanization down the road. They're not fully urban yet, but they are not going to be the growth story, and they are going to, I believe they're going to be the biggest bubble burst, and they're the ones already bringing down the emerging world and commodity prices, because the Chinese manufacturing machine and their people buy 40 to 50% of all the industrial commodities in the world. So China's a big deal. And you know, we've had slowing in you know, North American and European economies, and we've been using endless quantitative easing to kind of keep that at bay. But like I say, if this China real estate bubble blows, it's going to set off a chain reaction around the world, and there's not anything that quantitative easing in the U.S. and Europe can do. So this is what's going to blow the whole thing of banks trying to keep basically an economy that's already dead and peaked and try to keep bubbles alive, which only really benefits the top, you know, 0.1 to 1% to 10% of people who own most of the assets. So this is why most surveys I see, they survey the average person, they're like saying, what recovery? You know, we never came out of the recession from their point of view.
Well, if you're just joining us, we're chatting today with Mr. Harry Dent about his book, The Demographic Cliff. He is offering the listeners today a free copy of The Demographic Cliff. You need to pay only $4.95 for shipping and handling, and you can request your free book at harrydent.com. Harry, we've got just a couple minutes left in this segment. How will the average American listener listening to this program be affected, in your view, when China's real estate bubble bursts in earnest?
Well, you know, they'll be, in fact, we're going to have, and we've been saying this for years, we had the first wave down in real estate. That was kind of like stopped by quantitative easing. And now we're going to have the second wave. When bubbles burst, they typically go back to where they started. Real estate is still well above the early 2000 levels when the bubble started in most countries around the world and certainly in the United States. So that's what's going to impact. When the stock market goes down, the average person doesn't own a lot of stocks, especially after two big crashes that scared them out. But most people do own real estate, and we're going to see a deeper real estate crash. And around the world this time, it's not going to be just Spain or just U.S. or just Ireland. You're going to see bubbles burst around the world, and that's what's going to hit the banks the hardest, and that's what hits the everyday person. You get underwater on your house is worth less than your mortgage. Not only have you lost money and you're in trouble, but you can't even refinance to take advantage of lower interest rates. So that's the big thing I see. So we've been warning against real estate. Everybody thinks you can't go wrong long term in real estate. Japanese real estate, I always say, watch Japan. They've already gone through what we're going through. Japanese real estate is still down 60% residential 24 years after the peak, because there's now more older people dying who are sellers than younger people coming up and buying. So real estate will never be the same in an aging society. Young people buy homes, largely between age 27 and 41. That's what almost all the homes are bought. So when you start aging past that, like the baby boom is doing in most countries, and especially in Japan, there's just no demand for houses, and old people keep dying and selling them.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there for this segment. Our guest today is Mr. Harry Dent, best-selling author of The Demographic Cliff, and we'll get Harry's predictions for various markets when Everything Financial Radio returns. Stay with us.
Give me your money.
Welcome back to the Everything Financial Radio program. I'm your host, Dennis Tubergen. I have the pleasure today of chatting once again with best-selling author, Mr. Harry Dent, author of The Demographic Cliff. If you're just joining us, Harry's offering the listeners a free copy of the book, The Demographic Cliff. You pay just $4.95 to cover shipping and handling, and you can make your request at harrydent.com. Harry, let me jump in and pick up kind of where we left off in the last segment. And we were talking about real estate. Is it your take then that we are in another real estate bubble here in the United States, and that we're going to see a decline akin to what we saw 10 years ago?
Yeah. It's a second bubble. We haven't gone to new highs in most places, although Miami is, and San Francisco, certain places. But yes, we never really got to fully deleverage the bubble because, again, government stepped in with massive quantitative easing. Mortgage rates are at least 2 percentage points lower than normal. That's a free gift to everybody that buys a home or refinances. Even my car loans are now 2% when they used to be 5%. So, it has created a less extreme bubble, but we still have a long way to go. Just to get back down to January 2000 prices, where I documented the bubble started, where things started to go up exponential instead of normal with inflation, we'd have to fall another 40, 50%. So I mean, last time we fell 34%, and look how much turmoil that caused with underwater mortgages and how much banking problems and stuff and how much bailouts and stuff. So real estate, and throughout history, show that when you have a stock bubble burst, like the tech bubble or even the 29 bubble at first, stocks don't affect people as much. When real estate is at the center of a bubble, as farm real estate was in the 1920s bubble and in the 1830s bubble when everybody moved to the Midwest and Chicago became a big city, and when real estate's at the heart of speculation, the bubble, it has a bigger impact on everyday people and a much bigger impact on the banking system. So this is, if you thought 2008 and 2009 were bad, this is going to be worse because we've only kicked the can down the road 8 years here. So kicking the can down the road always kicks you harder when you finally face reality. So we're saying, one of the things we look at, Dennis, the markets, the stock market has a very clear pattern that everybody's ignoring on Wall Street. Each bubble has taken us to higher highs, 2000, 2007, and now in 2015. And each crash that's followed has taken us to lower lows. So if we went to like 6,400 something last time in the Dow, we're saying we're going to go to 5,500 to 6,000 next time and go from 18,000 something instead of 14,000. So I literally see like a 60-70% crash in stocks, much worse than 2008 and 9. And I think that's going to happen between now and early 2017. It's not going to take long because bubbles burst much faster than they build.
Harry, when you talk about the real estate bubble and talk about the fact that we're looking at maybe a 40 to 50% decline in real estate in your view, and then you look at the fact that we've got FHA-backed mortgages now with very little down for those with very low credit scores.
They're doing it again.
Aren't we repeating the same thing, and are we going to see more banking failures moving ahead, and will that be the catalyst for this stock market decline?
You know, well, they both feed on each other. The stocks will go first, and then real estate will follow and make the whole recession and downturn worse, and that will cause stocks to get hit harder. So and the same thing. Now, it's the opposite. You know, in China, the same thing. Stocks are bursting first. What you'll expect on a lag is real estate. Same thing happened in Japan. The stock burst happened about a year before real estate burst, but it was real estate that really brought Japan down and made this endless kind of deflationary recession they've been. They've been in a coma economy ever since, despite unbelievable levels of quantitative easing since 2013. So it's the real estate that really makes it serious, and real estate tends to take longer to find a bottom. Real estate peaked in early 2006. We were calling that in late 2015 in our newsletter. Very few people saw that coming. It took 6 years to find a bottom in 2012. And, of course, it's been bouncing back ever since. So this could be several years that real estate is falling. And the best thing people can do is lessen their exposure to real estate. We have a lot of friends our age that are sitting in big homes, and their kids have left the nest, and they're thinking about downsizing when they retire. I said, downsize now. If you're going to move from a 4,000-square-foot house to a 2,000-square-foot townhouse, do it now. You'll cut your exposure to real estate in half. I have been renting in Tampa, Florida, ever since October 2005, when we were warning the bubble was about to burst, and I have saved a ton of money. I saved $1 million loss, and my rent has been half of what my mortgage and property tax payments would have been. So we benefited. I mean, real estate's great when things are going up, but when it's going down, it's an expense. And, in our house, we probably avoided $40,000 of things, failing that the landlord had to pay for that we didn't. So we're actually happy renting.
Harry, let me ask you, moving ahead, what will Fed policy be? It seems like if we see another stock market crash, we see a real estate crash, that the Fed's going to try to go back to the well and maybe print again. And will that mean that we're headed toward a hyperinflationary environment, or are we still going to see deflation? How do you come down on that argument?
You know, it's still deflation because deflation is the trend. Young people are inflationary because they cost everything and produce nothing. Older people downsize everything. They spend less. They borrow less. They pay down debt. They even eat less. People weigh the most at 60 and then lose weight. And then, of course, they die at some point. All of this is deflationary. And Western societies and wealthy countries are all tipping towards this. But the other thing that causes deflation, even more so in history, when you have a debt bubble, and that always leads to financial asset bubbles, stock bubbles, real estate bubbles, commodity bubbles, all that sort of stuff, when those bubbles burst, debt deleverages, loans fail, money disappears, wealth in bubbles disappears and doesn't come back for a long time. And that disappearance of massive amounts of money, and the only time we saw that in modern history was in the Great Depression. in you know, back in the last century, you get deflation in prices. So all this quantitative easing that the gold bugs keep saying, it's going to cause inflation, going to cause inflation, hyperinflation, hyperinflation. No, they're just fighting. They're just counteracting deflation. They're trying to keep deflation from setting in, because when it does, as Ben Bernanke knew from studying the 30s, when deflation sets in, you have your worst economies. I mean, the inflation, we had the highest inflation in modern history in the 70s, and that was a difficult economy and recessionary. But nowhere near as difficulty, and no, and twice the unemployment in the Great Depression in the 1930s. And stocks went down 89% in the 1930s instead of, you know, 50 to 70 in the 70s. So deflation is what I call the winter season. It's the most challenging. But if investors understand, if you just get out of the bubble, you can short stocks if you want to take more risk, but that, I want people to sleep in it. Just get out of the bubble, put your money in safe stuff, let these crashes happen, and next thing you know, you're buying your dream home on a beach for 20 cents on the dollar, or you're buying, you know, leading stocks for 20, 30 cents on the dollar. That's how you make money in deflation, is you get out of the way and you rebuy after the crash. Like Joseph Kennedy, he made a family fortune in a matter of years by taking money from legging business cash flow and getting out of the markets and buying back at the bottom of the Great Depression. So that's what you have to do, unfortunately. People keep saying, well, what can I invest in? Where can I get a good yield? You're not going to get a good yield unless you go into junk bonds, and then junk bonds fall as bad as stocks do, just as they did in 2008 and 9. They were down 50, 60% like stocks. So you have to be in safe treasuries and stuff like that, get little or no yield. But then every time things fall, you're actually making money because you can buy it 10, 20, 30 cents on the dollar.
So, Harry, last question. Seems based on the conversation we just had about banking that parking your money in a bank, you should at the very least be careful. Where would you suggest someone move for safety? Where do you park this cash?
What you do, you know, you have to have a checking account. Don't have a minimum amount, just to do your business and pay your bills in a checking account, and then put everything else in a brokerage account. It can be a brokerage account at a bank or a brokerage firm or an online, you know, brokerage firm, or Charles Schwab, or anything. Have it in a brokerage firm in your name. The reason is, you put money in a bank account or a savings account, banks can lend against that. They call it reserves. They can lend 10 to 1 against the 10% reserve of your deposits. They're lending against your money, and if they lose money in this real estate crash, they may turn around, like a lot of banks did in the Great Depression, and say, you know, we say we have your money, but we actually don't have it. We lost it. So they can't lend that money if you have it in a brokerage account in your name, and then you get in safe stuff in that brokerage account, and when things start to crash, you start buying stuff at bargain prices years from now in an investment account, not in a savings.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. Our guest today has been Mr. Harry Dent. He is the author of the book, The Demographic Cliff. If you'd like to get a free copy of The Demographic Cliff, all you have to do is pay $4.95 shipping and handling. You can make your request at harrydent.com. And Harry, thanks for joining us today. We'd love to have you back.
Okay, great being back.
Everything Financial Radio returns after these words. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Everything Financial Radio program. Joining me on today's program is Mr. Ian Gordon of the Longwave Group. And Ian, we were talking previously on Everything Financial Radio about the fact that when you study history and study cycles, that whenever we get to this point in the cycle, a new monetary system evolves or emerges. And you had mentioned prior to our break and in a prior segment that it's your belief that this new monetary system will be based in gold, similar to monetary systems that have existed in the past. What are some countries to lead the way in this actually this new evolution of an old currency system?
I think that China will effectively take the lead, because, you know, China is very much the U.S. of the 1930s. And in the 1930s, the early 1930s, which is, you know, was the winter of the cycle of the previous cycle, and we're now in the winter of the current cycle, the the world monetary system, which was based on gold, collapsed. And China has been, and China is the U.S. because China is the world's largest creditor nation, and you know has accumulated massive amounts of particularly of U.S. debt. So she's been financing the U.S. debt for many years, and is the biggest holder still of U.S. debt, maybe equal with Japan now, but you know owns substantial amounts of debt. Of U.S. debt. So she's the world's largest credit nation, much as the U.S. was the world's largest credit nation in the 30s. And in that time, the, you know, the whole monetary system of the world collapsed between 1931 and 33. Everybody went off gold and effectively went to paper. So that's when the fiat paper money system was created. This time, around, China has been accumulating massive amounts of gold, and I'm pretty sure, I don't think she's ready for it yet, because she doesn't want to sort of come onto a gold standard system, because that would basically make the renminbi, you know, would absolutely, the value of the renminbi would increase dramatically, and if she announced a gold backing for the currency. So I think she, you know, if anything, China would like to devalue her currency here. But she is preparing, but through this accumulation of massive amounts of gold. And Russia, too, is also accumulating a large amount of gold. So they are preparing for a new system that it will eventually evolve as the fiat currency system, which led by the dollar, collapses.
Ian, will that be the point when the United States, when Europe, when Japan, all these countries that are having a central bank really print to help to monetize their deficits and debt, will that be the point that we have this big asset pricing reset? And if so, how will our listeners be affected? What will that look like?
I really think the real trauma will occur in the United States simply because she's enjoyed the privilege of the dollar being the world's reserve currency, and everybody effectively having to earn dollars to pay for commodities, whereas the U.S. can affect, you know, simply print those dollars. So that suddenly, what happens is when the system collapses and the dollar is no longer effectively an acceptable currency for the payment of these goods, and China and Russia are slowly squeezing out that privilege as we speak. But I think the repercussions for the U.S. will be the most dramatic, because suddenly she'll have to pay in something that people will consider to be an acceptable currency, and that acceptable currency will have to be something of a gold, you know, will be gold backed because, you know, the world will be moving to that gold backing. And if the U.S. doesn't have the gold that she purports to have, which I believe she doesn't, this will be very, it will make the dollar, via other currencies, almost have no value, and interest rates to support U.S. debt will rise dramatically, because the Federal Reserve just can't keep buying up those dollars, because you're effectively making the dollar even more worthless.
Ian, I've had guests on the program that agree that the U.S. Maybe doesn't have the gold that is reported. And they have said that when this occurs, that the only way that the United States will actually be able to engage in international trade will be with things that we produce here, like maybe agricultural exports, and that will drive the price of food for everyday Americans up to potentially even, you know, unaffordable levels. What would your take be on that position?
Well, I think when the whole system collapses, and I really believe that we're awfully close to this collapse, when the whole system collapses, we're going to go into a depression, much like, you know, the 30s, but actually substantially worse than the 30s. And so what happened in the 30s when the world went into a depression, the U.S. became basically very much an isolationist country. She was self-sufficient in oil. She was self-sufficient in foods and so on. So she extricated herself out of trade. World trade during the 30s dropped by 70%. So we're going to see the same sort of thing. You're going to see powers sort of move to strategic sort of trading blocks. And Russia and China particularly along the Silk Road and so on, they're already evolving in that direction. The U.S. will, you know, the dollar will be worthless, and I'm not sure that I think the whole debt system will collapse in the U.S. I mean, this is going to be a very, very, very difficult period in history.
So, Ian, I'm sure our listeners have a couple questions that have come to mind, as I have. One, you use the term awfully close. What in your view does that look like? Is awfully close within the year, within 5 years, within 10 years? Do you care to speculate?
My own feeling is it's at least, you know, I don't see how we can extend this beyond another 6 months. I really don't. You can see the desperation on the part of all central banks is trying to hold the system together, buying up all this debt and so on. You know, these are acts of desperation. And we know in other periods in history when we have been on paper money systems, that's always been the cause. It's always been the effect of the collapse of paper money is to effectively create much more of it to try and keep the system alive. And we're going through exactly the same period. If you look at the John Law's paper money scheme in France in the 1720s, you'll see as it started to collapse, as people started to refuse to accept it in payment, they created even more of it. And the same in the French Revolutionary period of the assignats, you know, in the French Revolutionary days, you know, they just created so much of it that eventually it became worthless. And this is really what the central banks are doing right now. They're just creating so much money to try to save the system, and the system will implode.
Ian, the second question that came to mind as you were making those comments is you'd mentioned this will be a very difficult period moving ahead, and certainly that's something that I would agree with. And you've mentioned in our past conversations here on the program that during this time frame, debt has to be purged from the system. So my question is, in your view, how long does this period last? How long does it take to get the debt purged from the system and go through this reset?
Well, again, we can look to the last depression, and you know, it effectively started in 29, and that, you know, it was a debt bubble that collapsed following 1929, and you know, it really took the Second World War to bring us out of that issue. You know, where you know, you still had very high unemployment. The U.S. unemployment numbers were still well over 10% by 1940. So it was the war that effectively brought us out of the depression. And both, you know, you had a major collapse in the U.S. banking system. 10,000 banks failed between 1929 and 1933. As I said earlier, I really think China is the U.S. of the 30s, and you'll see the same sort of problems occurring in China, where you will have a massive collapse in the banking system there, particularly the quasi-banks, you know, and China will come out of this, will evolve out of this as the supreme financial and economic power in the world, much as the U.S. did following the Depression.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. Ian, always a pleasure to talk to you. Your insights are fascinating. Thank you for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me.